Now, I want to talk today some more about homeostasis and maintaining balance in the body, and I wanted to talk primarily about the kidney. But in order to talk about the kidney, I think it's necessary to talk a little bit about circulation first. And so that's what we're going to do. And handout 19A has the basics of circulation that I wanted to talk about. Now, considering the circulation, we want to talk a little bit both about the heart and about the vessels that go through the heart. And what we have here on the top is what you might call a subway diagram, sort of like an old-fashioned subway map. And the point of this picture is that it shows you what's connected to what. It does not show you the shapes of things or the true distances at all. It only shows you what's connected to what. Now, you probably all know that we have a four-chambered heart, and the two top chambers are called the atria, as it has on your handout, and the bottom ones are called the ventricles. Now, from this picture, what happens is that blood, if we start here, blood flows in from the head and from the body. And then it goes through this atrium and then through this ventricle. This picture shows the heart, so to speak. A real picture of the heart, or a better picture, is underneath, which shows you in the middle something about the real anatomy and makes it clear that it's not flat like this at all. But this would be the heart of somebody facing you. So in that case, this would be their right side, and this would be their left. So what looks like the left is always the right side of the heart. So the blood comes from the body through the right side of the heart. And the point of this system is that there are really two loops of circulation, because the blood flows out of the right ventricle to the lungs. And then back from the lungs into the left half of the heart. And this loop through the lungs is called the pulmonary circulation. Now, what's shown here, just for the record, are the valves between the atria and the ventricles that, once the blood has been pushed from the atria to the ventricle, the valve closes and prevents backflow. That's what those are. And there are also valves here and here, so that once the blood has been pushed out into the circulation, it does not back up into the ventricles. Now, so the blood goes through from the body through the right half, and then it goes around through the lungs to the left half. So that's the pulmonary circulation. Through the lungs. And now, through the left, it goes through the left side, and from there, it is pumped out into the main body, to the main circulation. Now, what do you call blood vessels? You all know about arteries and veins. We tend to think of arteries having oxygenated blood and veins having used up deoxygenated blood. Well, that's only true for the main circulation. By definition, an artery goes away from the heart. So anything that comes out this side is an artery. And anything that returns to the heart is a vein. So everything at the top is a vein. Now, that means that in the main circulation, what goes out of the heart through the artery has oxygen, and what comes back through the vein does not. But it's the opposite for the pulmonary circulation, because what comes out of the right side of the heart and goes to the lungs is the old used up blood carrying CO2 from the body. Then it goes to the lungs, gives up its CO2, and picks up oxygen. And it's now oxygenated blood that flows through the pulmonary vein, through the left heart, side of the heart, and out to the body. Now, we've talked about arteries and veins, and just to make it clear, that arteries branch into arterioles, which branch into capillaries, which then collect into a venule, which then collect into a vein. Now, what's different about these is there is smooth muscle around arteries and arterioles and around venules and veins, but not around capillaries. Capillaries have a single layer of epithelial cells, which, as we've said earlier, are called endothelial cells, that surround the capillary. So this means that almost all exchange, either with the body or with the lungs, happens through capillaries. That CO2 comes in from the body, oxygen goes out in the lungs, oxygen comes in, CO2 goes out, is almost all through capillaries, not through the others. Now, putting everything we've said together, you get the picture on the bottom, which is, again, a subway diagram of the basic circulation. And what they've done now is to separate the two halves of the heart. So here is the right half. Here is the left half, each with its atrium and its ventricle. Because they want to illustrate here that there are two loops of circulation, and one is through the lungs, and the other is through the body. Now, each of these boxes here, not the heart, but all the other boxes, represent a capillary bed. So what's always happening in the box is the incoming vessel is branching into capillaries, which are then being picked up and going back into the vessel on the other side. So there's always a set of capillaries in each of the boxes. Now, you notice what happens in the body. This makes it clear over here that the blood flows not in series, but in parallel through each of the organs. So, for example, some vessels go through the muscle, some go through the kidney, some through the digestive tract, brain, etc. So blood is going through these in parallel and then all being collected, going through the right side, being pushed into the lungs, picking up oxygen, and going around again. Now, suppose there were a portal vessel in here. Where would it be? What does a portal vessel do? It normally connects two sets of capillaries. So it would go between, say, here. If there were a portal vessel, it would go here. Now, there isn't one here. There is one between the digestive tract and the liver, but there isn't any here. But if there were, this would allow blood to go from the muscle to the kidney, which, of course, it can't. How can the same blood cell go from the muscle to the kidney? It has to go through the muscle all the way around again and then go through the kidney because there is no portal vessel here. Yeah?
When we say it goes from the muscle to the kidney, does it really just go everywhere and it happens to be in the kidney as well, or does
right. I think your question is, does any particular blood cell go anywhere? And the answer is yes. That the blood branches here. Some of it flows through the muscle. Some of it flows through the kidney. Some of it flows through each tissue. And this is regulated, how much flows through each one. But any one blood cell can end up anywhere. Any other questions about this? So with this in mind, we want to consider how the kidney operates. What does the kidney do? The kidney controls what gets lost in the urine and what is retained in the body. And that means both how much water is lost or retained and how much of many nutrients or ions or drugs is lost or retained. And in order to see, one way of looking at this is that there are four basic processes which take place in the kidney. So we're going to name what they are, but then we have to look at the structure of the kidney to understand how they work. So the four processes that we want to talk about, one is filtration. This is how liquid gets from the blood to the kidney. Then there was called reabsorption. You have liquid derived from the blood with a lot of stuff in it. Some of that stuff is removed from the liquid and saved by the body. That's what reabsorption is. It's basically saving stuff so you can keep it. try and close this because I can see some people are looking around. Okay. Now, just as some stuff is selectively pulled out of the liquid and kept, some stuff is specifically pushed into the liquid and lost. And that's called secretion. Now, one way of looking at what the kidney does is the kidney excretes materials. Material which is in the urine when it leaves is said to be excreted. Now, if it was excreted, it wasn't reabsorbed. Was it secreted for sure? And the answer is no. Some of the stuff in the liquid is neither reabsorbed nor is it secreted. It just happened to be there and it stays there. So secretion is selective, putting specific things into what will be urine. Reabsorption is selective, taking special things out. But whatever happens to be in the urine itself is excreted. And the point I'm making here is that excretion and secretion are not the same thing. They are different. And now there's a final stage, and that's the control of the volume. And that happens near the end of the process and is under the control primarily of ADH, but also to some extent aldosterone. So what we want to look at is filtration happens first. How does that happen? Then how do reabsorption and secretion work? And then finally, volume control. But in order to do that, we have to look at structure because this is a case where structure and function are very strongly related. So now you want to look at 19B. Which has several pictures. I can't do it. Which has several pictures of the kidney looking at it from different points of view. So you have two kidneys, but here's a picture sort of what one kidney looks like. You see these structures that look like this. The kidney, just like the adrenal medulla, is divided into two layers, an outer and inner layer. And the outer layer is referred to as the cortex. And the inner part, just as with the adrenal, is called a medulla. Now, in the medulla, you see these structures that are called renal pyramids. And they represent part of the critical unit of the kidney. The functional unit of the kidney is the nephron. And that's actually what we've drawn here on the right. This is sort of what one nephron looks like. Now, what a renal pyramid is it's the bottom part of many nephrons. So in your little picture, we've drawn a nephron here to sort of give you the picture. But a renal pyramid is not one nephron. It's the bottom parts of many nephrons. Because the top part of the nephron is in the cortex, and the bottom part is in the medulla. Now, to get straight what we're looking at here, each nephron has these two so-called convoluted tubules. This is the proximal tubule. This is the distal tubule. Now, as before, proximal means close, distal means far, and everybody is thinking from the start point because the liquid comes in here. And this is called Bowman's capsule. And all of these terms are in the notes, so you can use whatever abbreviations you like and recover it. So the liquid comes in Bowman's capsule and then goes through the proximal tubule, but then it goes through this loop. And this is called the loop of Henle. And it has two critical parts. So how does the liquid flow? If liquid goes through the proximal, it's going to go this way. This is the descending loop. And then it's going to come back up. And that's the ascending loop. Now, you notice in the picture below, we've untwisted it to make it a little easier to follow what's happening. So in the picture below, We've just sort of drawn it like this, where this would be descending, and this is coming back up ascending. The liquid is going this way, but we've untwisted it, even though the real anatomy is twisted, just to make it easier to follow. Now, one of the major reasons for drawing the bottom picture is to remind you that this so-called line here is really a tube. That this is a tube or tubule, and this picture makes that clearer, that this is the space or lumen inside the kidney tubule. And that what we really have here is that the tube is surrounded by a layer of epithelial cells. So we drew one cell here to remind you. It's over here. But there's actually a whole layer of cells all the way around this. Now, did you ever hear before of a tube surrounded by a layer of cells? Remember the GI tract? It turns out that these are epithelial cells, which are in many ways like the ones that line the GI tract. They have a great many similarities, and we'll talk about them in detail in a few minutes. But just to go back to this original picture, there's one or two parts we didn't finish. So the liquid comes in through Bowman's capsule, through the proximal, down through the loop of Henle, and up through the distal proximal. And then we have here... This is a collecting duct. Many different nephrons are connected to the same collecting duct. So another nephron would feed in here, and one would feed in here, and one would feed in here, and the urine then would all come down through the collecting duct. It's actually, I guess, pre-urine at this point, and then comes all together into the ureter and out as urine. Now, this is the basic structure, but what about capillaries? Remember we talked about blood flow and all that? Liquid has to get actually into this inside, the lumen of this tubule. Liquid has to pass from the blood to the inside of this tubule, and then some things will be reabsorbed back out. Some things will be secreted back in, etc. So how does liquid go either from the blood to the kidney tubule or vice versa? And to see that, we have to draw in some capillaries. And for that, I need my colored chalk, which is here somewhere. Okay. Now, there are actually two sets of capillaries here. This is one of those exceptional situations where you have an arteriole and it generates a set of capillaries and then they collect back into a vessel and then you get another set of capillaries. So you have two sets of capillaries in series. And the first set is how the liquid gets from the blood into the kidney. So you have one set of capillaries that are called capillaries, or the capillaries of the glomerulus. Now, what do we mean by a glomerulus? The blood that comes in here, and then it goes through a sort of convoluted path and out again. By having this multiple turns, you have here a structure with a huge surface area through which liquid can pass out of the capillaries into the blood, into the kidney tubule. So blood flows this way, and this is called the afferent arteriole. We talked about afferent and efferent last time when we were talking about circuits, that afferent sort of means into the center and efferent is out. So afferent is into the glomerulus, and then you have afferent, and then you have the efferent arteriole, which goes out. Now, in the subway diagram business, suppose we were to draw this. So we're saying you have the afferent And then it branches into this capillary bed. This would be where the glomerulus is. And then you have these joined together into the efferent arteriole. So these are both arterioles. But now it branches, the efferent arteriole branches into another capillary bed. And these capillaries surround the loop of Henle and the proximal and distal tubules. And so I'm going to draw them a little differently, sort of like this. So these are called the peritubular capillaries. And so if I were to draw them, they would just look something like that. Whoops. Oh, well. You get the picture. So, and then, of course, the peritubular capillaries come back together, and what comes out of here is a venule. Okay. Now, what you need these for is that if material is going to be secreted, it has to come out of the capillaries and be secreted into the tubule, liquid. If it's going to be reabsorbed, it has to come out of the tubule and then eventually go back to capillaries and return to the blood supply. So that's why you need this second set of capillaries. Now, having talked about all this structure, how do you put it together to do anything? So let's go back and look at our four processes. And for this, it might be easier to look at 19C at the upper left. Now, what we have here is this is Bowman's capsule. This is the part at the top. And the glomerulus is in here. So blood is flowing in here. And then it's flowing out again. So this is the afferent arteriole. This is the efferent. And this picture illustrates the three major processes at the beginning. Filtration or glomerular filtration, that's what GF is, and reabsorption, tubular secretion, and tubular reabsorption. So this is reabsorption, this is secretion, and this is filtration. So this is where filtration occurs. Liquid is forced out of the capillaries across the cells that line this tubule, across the cells into the tubule lumen. And that's what filtration is. Now, why do people call it filtration? Because it really does act like a filter. Cells do not go into the tubule. They're too big. Large proteins don't go into the tubule either. So the tubule has small molecules and a few very small proteins. So all the cells of the blood and all the big proteins go out the efferent arteriole and remain in the blood. But for every pass, about 20% of the liquid enters the tubule, and about 80% just goes on from afferent to efferent back to the circulation. But now, what about this absorption, reabsorption, and secretion business? Remember over here, these are the peritubular capillaries. This is the second set of capillaries. And how is something secreted? It leaves the peritubular capillary, goes through the space between the cells, crosses the cells surrounding the tubule, and enters the tubule. So this would be secretion. But what about reabsorption? It's just the reverse. So resorption means that materials go through the cells, through the interstitial fluid, and into the capillary. Now, we're leaving out the control of volume part because that occurs down near the end. Filtration occurs here in the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. Most secretion, most reabsorption occurs here in the proximal. And some secretions in the proximal, I think, and some in the distal. So, and the part of volume control is the end of the distal and the collecting ducts, so we'll get to that later. Now, how does this work on a cellular level? We're not going to worry about filtration at a cellular level. If you want to see the anatomy of it, you should look in books. But we want to look a little more closely at the cellular basis of selective reabsorption and secretion, in part because it's very similar to processes we've already talked about in the GI tract. So the easiest way to see that is, again, to look at 19C, where what they've done in the bottom is to blow up a little part of this. So what you've got here is a layer of cells and another layer of cells. Not drawing them very well. So this is the lumen, or the space inside the kidney tubule. Over here would be one capillary, but they've left it off because the picture they're drawing only has that side and not this side. So they've left off what's over here. And they've only drawn the whole shebang on this side. That what you have is, these are the cells, and of course they go all the way around, and they are joined by tight junctions. So there would be tight junctions here. And in fact, these are very similar to the cells, the epithelial cells, which line the GI tract, where here's the lumen, apical side, basolateral. This is a very similar deal. Where's the apical side of this cell? Well, the apical part is the part that faces the lumen, right? AKA luminal, if you look on your handout. And that's actually this side. So this is the apical or the luminal side. And this is the basolateral side. So compared to our previous picture, we've rotated it 90 degrees this way. Okay. Now, how do things get then? As shown here, they've shown reabsorption. In order for something to get out of this fluid, how is it going to get into the capillary? Well, it's going to have to get across the luminal surface using some sort of pump or some sort of carrier. And then it's going to have to go out the basolateral surface. And then it's going to have to go through the interstitial fluid. And then it's going to have to enter the capillary. And then the capillary carries it around through the circulation. Now, this is the general idea. And as you go along the tubule, certain things are always the same. There's always a sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral side. What primarily varies is what pumps, carriers, etc., are found on the luminal or apical side. They vary a lot. In certain parts of the tubule, certain things are taken in and you have the right pumps and carriers. In other parts, it's different. So what's on this surface is the most variable. There is some variation in channels and pumps on the backside, on the basolateral, but relatively less. So let's do an actual example. And that's what's shown in the upper right. Instead of talking in general terms, they've got a specific example. How is sodium reabsorbed? Now you have to be careful here about the in and out business. When you say in or out, do you mean in and out of the tubule, in and out of the cells surrounding the tubule, in and out of the blood, etc.? In this case, they're talking about taking sodium out of the lumen and getting it back into the general circulation, which means it has to end up in the plasma. Now, we already know from things we talked about in class, and this was, I think, on one of your exams in a different context, that you have the sodium-potassium pump always working on the basolateral side. So that is removing sodium. So in this case, the critical part is having a channel for sodium on the luminal side. So as they show here in the top cell, if you have a channel for sodium, then the pump pulls it out, keeping the sodium level low, and sodium will come in from the lumen by diffusion into the cell. And then it will be pumped out the other side and will go by diffusion into the capillary. Now, this is how you get sodium out of the tubule into the circulation. Let's think about something that goes the other way. If you had something that went the other way, it would be have to be pushed or pumped across one surface and probably passively move across the other. But it's the cells here that actually do the secretion or the reabsorption. They pull or push things one way or the other. But if you pull something in, it then has to be carried away by the blood. If you're pushing something out, how did you get it to push? It must have come from the blood. So reabsorption means you're pulling something this way, which means you're pulling it by diffusion from the blood. Now, I want to consider one other example. You actually recover glucose and amino acids from the blood. Excuse me, from the tubule. From the lumen of the tubule. How would you do that? What would that take? If you had amino acids here, or glucose, let's take glucose. How could you get glucose back into the body? And in fact, you do. You don't lose, a normal person doesn't lose any glucose in their urine. It's all recovered, which is which process? It's all reabsorbed. So how would you do that? You got a suggestion? A sodium glucose co-transporter. You can actually do it with exactly the same process that you use with the cells lining the GI tract. That is, you have a sodium glucose co-transporter on the luminal surface and a passive carrier-mediated transport, one of those glute transporters, on the basolateral surface. So that glucose is picked up actively, secondary active transport on this side, and then leaves passively, goes into the blood on the other side.
Does that mean you have to have an NA pump on the other side
too? Does that mean you have to have an NA pump on the other side too? And yes, the answer is yes, that you virtually always have a sodium-potassium pump on the basolateral side, which serves the function of a sodium pump.
You don't have to have high sodium concentration? No, okay.
Her question is, if you're going to have glucose-sodium co-transport, something has to pull the sodium and keep the sodium low in the cell, and that's what the sodium-potassium pump does. Now, one of the points we're making here is that in some parts of the tubule, what's on the luminal surface is the sodium channel. And in that part of the tubule, you're going to pull in sodium. In other parts of the tubule, what you have is a glucose-sodium co-transporter, and in that part of the tubule, you're going to pull in glucose. So it's going to be different. So maybe the easiest thing to do now is just to follow some liquid through the nephron and see what happens. So what we want to do is go back to this picture, which is on 19B on the bottom, and consider what is happening as stuff flows through here. And maybe I'll redraw it a little bigger. Filtration happens in the glomerulus. Liquid is pushed through here. And it contains then all the liquid components of the blood except large proteins. And in the proximal tubule, things like amino acids and glucose are recovered. So they are reabsorbed. So using this process we've discussed here, both amino acids and glucose are recovered by secondary active transport. So remember, there are cells here, and we're seeing that glucose and amino acids are moved across the luminal side using secondary active transport, and then they leave the basolateral side using carrier-mediated transport, passive transport down their gradient, and then from here they go through the interstitial fluid to the capillary. Now, the background noise here is due to the mic. Should I turn the mic down? Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure which of the two does it, but let's try that. No, that just turns it off. Is that okay? Yeah, fine. Okay. So who needs the growls? So the only other thing is you do lose some water in this part because you're losing sodium, and water follows sodium. Now, to make that clearer and what's going on in here, we want to talk about osmolarity. Osmolarity refers to total dissolved particle or total solute concentration. So if you have 1 molar glucose and you dissolve it, you get 1 mole of particles, and that's 1 osmole. But if you have 1 mole of sodium chloride, when you dissolve it, you get 2 moles of ions, because you get 1 set of sodium ions and 1 set of chloride ions. So 1 molar sodium chloride is 2 osmolar. So when you think of the liquid flowing through the tubule, people think about its osmolarity. Not so much concentration, but osmolarity. How many particles are in here through this process? Now, what basically happens is that as liquid flows down through the descending loop of Henle, water is removed. And the reason for that is that there is a gradient of salt in the medulla of the kidney. So out here, outside the cells, is a salt gradient. So this solution has a lower osmolarity, and so water flows out. So that means that the cells here, the membranes of the cells, are permeable to water. And the water flows passively out, trying, so to speak, to dilute the salt on the outside. So it flows by osmosis. So water leaves. So gradually, what happens to the osmolarity of this solution? If we leave the salt, or whatever is dissolved in here, and we take away water, what happens to the osmolarity? It's going to go up because we've removed water. So the osmolarity reaches a max at the bottom of the loop of Henle. But now, for most of the ascending, the situation is different. Here, you remove salt, primarily, so we're focused on the sodium, but of course there's also chloride. Now, what we mean by that is this is an active process using a pump. So it's being removed, just as we discussed over there. Sodium is being pumped out the backside, the basolateral side, by the sodium-potassium pump, and then it's Since there are channels in the luminal side, the sodium diffuses in down its gradient and is pumped out the backside. That, in fact, is where the sodium gradient comes from, where the sodium on the outside came from being pumped out of the ascending side. Now, in order for this to work, notice we're removing sodium. Usually, if you have high salt over here, what happens to the water? The water diffuses out trying to dilute the salt. So these cells have membranes that are impermeable to water. It's really the luminal side that has to be impermeable. So this part, the cells surrounding it are impermeable to water. This is unusual. Most membranes are at least a little bit permeable. Okay. Now, so first you get rid of the water, concentrating the pre-urine. Then you get rid of the salt. And in fact, you get rid of so much salt that at some point around here, you have the minimum osmolarity, which is actually lower than it is in the blood. If the osmolarity is the same as the blood, you say the solution is isoosmotic to blood. If the solution is more dilute than blood, you say it's hypoosmotic. And if it's more concentrated, it's hyperosmotic. So the fluid is hyperosmotic down here, very high osmotic, high osmolarity. And then it becomes more and more dilute as you remove the sodium. So at this point, it's actually hypoosmotic. And this can then be adjusted, as we'll explain. Well, in fact, it usually is adjusted, so by the time you've gone up a little bit, you're more or less isoosmotic. What the hell is the point? You started out with isoosmotic, you did all the shenanigans, blew all this energy pumping things around, and you're isoosmotic again. Huh? Why? Is there any advantage to this? Do you have the same volume here that you had there? No way. You have a much smaller volume. You've done it in two stages. You got rid of first water and then salt. But now you have a much smaller volume. So there's much less to deal with here. So that's sort of advantage. That's really the point of this. Now, what's the point of having a point at which the osmolarity is actually very low? In this part, the end of the distal tubule, and in the collecting ducts, you can control the removal of a little bit of salt, and you can control the removal of water. So by controlling removal of water, what if you don't do anything? If you don't take anything out, then the urine will be hypoosmotic. You can get rid of a lot of fluid if you need to do it. If you remove some of the water, then this becomes isoosmotic. And if you're more or less in balance, that's fine. You get rid of that. However, you can remove even more water so that the urine can become quite hyperosmotic. And that allows you to conserve water. You save most of the water and just give a little bit of very concentrated urine. So this system, by starting here with minimal osmolarity, means that you can give urine, which is very dilute, to same as blood, to very concentrated, depending on your need to conserve or release water. Okay. Now, I want to say a little bit more about the invents here. Let's see if we left anything out. This is called a countercurrent system. You have flow in opposite directions, and in addition, it gets more concentrated or higher osmolarity on one side and lower on the other. Without going into the details, the peritubular capillaries are set up so they do not disturb this gradient of salt and do not carry it away. And this gradient of salt is what allows you to remove water here and, in fact, to remove water later. Why do I say later? When you get over here to the collecting duct, if you have permeability to water, why will water flow out of the tubule? Because you have high salt. Since there's high salt, if you let the water go, it will flow out into that high salt and stay in the body. If you don't let it flow, it will stay in the urine and leave. And that salt gradient then, besides a controlled opening of the valve, so to speak, allows you to control the water, the volume of urine. So let's come back to this. How did you get the salt gradient in the first place? Without going into details, the easiest way is to think about starting with the ascending. If you started with no salt gradient at all, you can pump salt out here, out of the tubule, into the interstitial fluid. And because it's active transport, you can get more sodium out here than you had inside. So you pump sodium out. But then more liquid comes around, and remember this liquid is pretty concentrated, so more liquid comes along and you pump more salt out. So you keep pumping salt out. Now, as you pump salt out and the salt builds up, then as fresh fluid comes in, you take more water out of it and it becomes more concentrated. So you're feeding more concentrated stuff into the eat salt machine or the pump salt machine. So it's probably easier to think of the ascending happening first and setting up the salt gradient, and then that pulls the water out in the descending limb, and then that provides you with a concentrated solution from which to pump more salt. So the situation reaches a steady state in which there is higher salt on the bottom and lower as you go up. Now, what about the rest of this process? We said that the actual volume of the urine, and to some extent its osmolarity, is controlled by the two hormones, aldosterone and ADH. Now, let me talk about aldosterone first, because it happens first. Aldosterone largely affects events in the end of the distal tubule. And what it affects are all of these processes that we drew here if we take off the glucose. Aldosterone, remember, is a steroid hormone. So what it promotes is the synthesis of all of these proteins that you need to move sodium. More channel protein, more pump protein. And therefore, more sodium moves. So what happens here is you remove sodium if you have aldosterone. If you don't have aldosterone, then whatever sodium is here just keeps going. Now, when you remove sodium, water follows it. So aldosterone causes the removal of both sodium and water. ADH affects only water. Now, the amount or percentage of the total of the salt that's removed by aldosterone is quite small. Now, when we say removed, what are we removing it from? We're removing it from the lumen, from the tubule, from the pre-urine. So when we say remove salt, we mean retain it in the body. So this is that in-out thing that you have to keep track of. We're talking about reabsorption. So only a small percent is retained in the body because of aldosterone, but a small percent of a large number is a lot of salt. And so this little bit affected by aldosterone can make a difference in things like blood pressure. Now, where does ADH come in? ADH may work on the very end of the proximal tubule, and it works on the collecting ducts. And ADH affects water channels. So let me draw that for how it goes. here's your tubule, and here are the cells lining the tubule. Now, it turns out that there are pores for water, or permeability for water, on the basolateral surface. And these are constitutive. So here is the liquid coming down the collecting ducts. And water can pass the basolateral membrane. But water can't always pass the apical membrane, the luminal membrane. Why? There are these movable water channels that work the way GLUT4 does in response to insulin. These water channels work in response to ADH. So there are two possible states. One is that the channels are in the membrane of a vesicle. I'm only going to draw one side, but it would be the same on the other. And the other possibility is that these vesicles fuse with the membrane on the luminal side, and in that case, the water channels will be inserted in the luminal membrane. Which of these cases is with ADH? One or two? And I want you to take 30 seconds and discuss that with the person next to you. Which of these is with ADH? Think of the name ADH and what it means. Let's take a vote. How many people think this one is ADH? How many people think this one is ADH? Notice it is not unanimous. This is not obvious. Now, let's think about the water and maybe it'll be clearer. Where does the water go if you have this case? The water goes out in the urine, right? Is that diuretic or anti-diuretic? That's diuretic. That means more urine. On the other hand, what about this case? Where will the water go? Some of it, at least, will go into the cells and retained in the body. And less will come out through the tubule. So is this anti or diuretic? This is anti-diuretic. When I was an undergraduate, I took a course in biochemistry. And I had this very proper professor with a bow tie and the whole bit. And he said, diuretic means to pee. Anti-diuretic means not to pee. And I was shocked, but I've remembered it all these years. So, not bad. So, what happens here is you're going to have less volume. So, this, in fact, is anti-diuretic hormone case. So, what does anti-diuretic hormone do? It promotes the fusion, then, of these vesicles with the plasma membrane so that you do, from this case to that. It causes the insertion of those preformed water channels into the luminal membrane, so now water can leave the tubule and remain in the body. And it does the action. Now let's just think for a minute. We've talked about, yeah?
Are those channels only present in the descending loop?
Not the descending loop. These channels are present in the collecting duct and perhaps in the very end of the distal tubule, but not in either part of the loop of Henle. Okay. Now, let's think for a minute. Where are the receptors for ADH? ADH, remember, is a what?
Steroid.
No. ADH is not a steroid. Aldosterone is a steroid. So aldosterone is a steroid. And ADH is a protein, it's a peptide actually, it's a peptide from the posterior pituitary. So while we're at it, where are the receptors for aldosterone in the right part of the tubule? They're going to be inside the cells. Because aldosterone is a steroid, its receptor is internal, it's a transcription factor. And the effects of aldosterone, are they going to be immediate or take a while? They're going to take a while because you're going to have to make these proteins in order to up sodium reabsorption. Now, on the other hand, what's with ADH? Is that effect immediate?
Yes.
Well, this effect is immediate. The movement of the channels is immediate. But the effect on the urine volume takes a while because it only affects the formation of new urine, not what you already got. Though ADH has another effect as well, which is immediate, and that it causes vasoconstriction. That's how it got its other name, vasopressin. But to come back to this case, where are the receptors then for ADH? Are they on the cell surface or inside? They have to be on the surface because a peptide can't cross the membrane. But which surface are they on? How many people think it's on the luminal surface? Basolateral surface. Too early in the morning. Okay. Well, where does ADH come from? Comes from the posterior pituitary, goes where? It has to go into the blood. So where's the blood in this picture? The blood is on here, closer to the basolateral side. So the ADH is going to be in the capillaries, it's going to diffuse out, and the receptors are going to be on the basolateral side. But where do you get action? The action is on the luminal side. But this works through a G-protein coupled receptor, and in this case, it works through cyclic AMP. Now, I want to talk about regulation of this, but let me ask first if there are questions about this so far. Yeah?
When you were mentioning how different cells have the end of the channel with the glucose.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a specific order in the thing to make it so like the maximum amount goes through where most of the energy channels are after the glucose to the last?
Oh, her question is, since different cells in different parts of the tubule have different transporters, what's located where, sort of thing. The recovery of almost all amino acids, glucose, and things of that sort happens here. So these cells have the transporters for that. Then where would you have sodium channels? Remember, you have the pump everywhere. But sodium channels you have in most of the ascending loop. And then you have some here in response to aldosterone. When there's no aldosterone, you don't have much here in this part. So you recover most of your stuff that you need first, and then you remove the sodium later. Now, I'm not sure where the secretion occurs. Most drugs and toxins and some ions are secreted, that is, they're specifically pumped into the tubule. And some of that happens in the proximal and some in the distal, and I'm not sure the proportions. Yeah?
How do you maintain a salt gradient outside in the sense that there's more salt down the ladder that you... That there's a pump there, I understand, but how do you maintain the left side that it's unequalized? The salt itself...
His question, do you mean that why doesn't the salt equalize this way or why doesn't it equalize this way?
Along the left ladder, like you said, there's more salt.
Well, remember that this is embedded in the medulla and the salt can move this way. So it's spread all over the medulla. But the question is, why doesn't this equalize? And the rationale for that is, it's sort of circular, but if you start from this side, the concentration here is the highest. So if you pump out salt into the body so that it's always, let's say, 200 osmolar, milliosmolar higher than inside, you get a high concentration here. Then what goes up further is more dilute. And then you pump out what is 200 higher than it. So the salt is, there's more salt here and less here and less here and less here. But the explanation of exactly how you generate this gradient and maintain it is actually quite complicated. And we've sort of glossed over it, and I recommend looking up. Purvis has an explanation of it in more detail. And let me just say one more time that it's important that the peritubular capillaries are set up in a way so as not to wash this away without going into the details. More questions? Any more about this? Okay. So we want to think about the issue of regulation of all of this. If you don't have enough flow through the kidney, this process doesn't operate properly. And so how do you maintain sufficient flow? There are two ways that this is regulated, as we've said, by ADH and to some extent by aldosterone. And that these, how do these affect this process? Let's start with ADH. There are two different receptors for ADH. One that detects in the arteries, which detects blood pressure, and one in the hypothalamus, which detects osmolarity. Now, the reason that you have two is that ADH controls the volume which of water which is released. Therefore, it controls the volume which is kept. Now, why would you want to keep water? That is, that's when you need ADH. If either the blood is too concentrated and the osmolarity is too high, then you need to keep water in to dilute your blood. On the other hand, what if your blood pressure is too low? Then you need to get water, to retain water to increase the volume of blood to keep up your blood pressure. Now, that's true for other reasons as well. It's true because of the kidney, because you have to have enough flow through here. Also, clearly, if you have some kind of catastrophic event and you bleed, you have to do something about your blood pressure or you will die. It turns out that most of the time, it is this receptor that's critical. Most of the time, thank goodness, you don't have a catastrophic loss of blood. And small fluctuations in osmolarity trigger this sensor. This sensor that responds to blood pressure is apparently not very sensitive. And so small variations in blood pressure don't have any effect. But if you have a catastrophic loss of blood, then this sensor kicks in and is, of course, very important. And both of these are integrated by the hypothalamus, which then has two effects. One is the secretion of ADH, that is synthesis of ADH in the cell bodies in the hypothalamus and in release in the posterior pituitary. And the other is to trigger thirst. Now you can see that these are two ends of the same thing. If you don't have enough liquid, there are two things you can do. You can conserve what you've got or you can take in more. So the thirst allows you to take water in, and the ADH allows you to keep the water that you've got and not release it in urine. So this is water retention. Now remember we said ADH has another function? It has that other name, vasopressin, because it constricts the peripheral arterioles. And in a moment of crisis, this can be very important because it also acts as a vasoconstrictor, which means that it cuts off the blood flow to the peripheral circulation and forces the blood into the main circulation so that your organs, your major organs, get enough blood. And your fingers get a little numb, big deal. So it does all of these, this, all of these at once. Now what about aldosterone? To explain aldosterone, I want to come at it from another angle. What we've got here are sensors that are not in the kidney at all. These are sensors that are actually in either the arteries or the brain, which trigger your brain to take action to fix overall blood concentration and blood pressure. But there's also sensors in the kidney itself, If the blood pressure is too low, there's not enough filtration, not enough liquid comes through. And the kidney monitors what is called the GFR, which is the glomerular filtration rate. So this is just the rate of filtration. If the rate of filtration is too low, then this sensor in the kidney itself has an effect on the flow. And there are two things that it does. The first one is very local. Remember, we have the set of glomerular capillaries. We have the efferent arteriole and the glomerular capillaries. So we have efferent and afferent. In, out. What if the glomerular filtration rate is too low? One of the first things that happens is to dilate the afferent arteriole. So basically, instead of these being the same size, balancing it in and out, you have a narrower exit and a wider entry, and that creates pressure. And so you get more push into the kidney. Now, if that takes care of the problem, that's it. But if that's not sufficient, then you get a series of events which triggers the release of aldosterone. And the way this works has several steps. Where does aldosterone come from? It actually comes from the adrenal cortex. Now, what triggers the adrenal to release aldosterone? That turns out to be something called angiotensin, or angiotensin 1. The precursor of angiotensin is always in your circulation, and it's called angiotensinogen. I think that's right. Angiotensinogen. So remember we talked about chymotrypsinogen and trypsinogen, this being an enzyme that is not active. And in order, this is around all the time, but in order for it to be activated, you need an enzyme called renin. Now you need several factors to do this, and it has several steps. But renin catalyzes the rate limiting step. You'll excuse the expression. When I put this on an exam, I got a lot of grief. By which I mean that this catalyzes the slowest step in the process. The other steps have their enzymes there all the time. So the critical step is this one. If you add renin, the whole conversion goes faster. So renin comes from the kidney. So if the GFR is down, the kidney supply of renin is up. So, what's the whole thing? The filtration into the kidney is insufficient. So the kidney releases renin. That causes conversion of angiotensin in the blood to angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1, and angiotensin 1 is what triggers the cortex to release aldosterone.
Aldosterone allows.
Now, what does aldosterone do? What aldosterone does is to stimulate sodium reabsorption by the end part of the distal tubule. Now, remember, if you retain sodium, you will retain water with it, and that will increase your blood volume and your blood pressure. Yeah.
I think in the lecture notes it says angiotensin 2.
Oh, you're right. It's angiotensin 2. You're right. It actually is broken down in two steps. It goes from angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And the critical renin is actually to angiotensin 1, but this has two steps in it. But the final product is angiotensin 2. That's correct. Okay, so angiotensin has other effects as well, But one of its effects is to cause the release of aldosterone, which then increases your blood pressure, which then increases the push of the blood and the infiltration rate. Now, you notice here that we have a lot of correctives if your blood pressure gets too low. We don't have much in the way of a corrective if your blood pressure gets too high. There is another hormone that affects it, but it doesn't have such a big effect. And that's why, medically speaking, you always hear about high blood pressure and not about low blood pressure. There are people with low blood pressure, but high blood pressure is a much more common effect that you don't have a homeostatic mechanism for dealing with so well. Now, let me just compare this to one other thing before we stop here. Is there some other hormone we know of released from the adrenal cortex?
Cortisol.
Remember cortisol? Now, there's also the small amounts of sex hormones, but we haven't discussed how that works. But what causes you to release cortisol? It's a totally different system. It is ACTH from the anterior pituitary, triggered by releasing factors from the hypothalamus. So that it's the same organ here, and these are both steroid hormones. But the mechanism for releasing the two is entirely different. That cortisol is under the control of the hypothalamic anterior pituitary axis, but aldosterone regulation is under really control of the kidney. Now we're going to stop here, and Tuesday the lecture will be in the morning by Dr. Feierstein, and then I'm giving the same lecture in the evening because he has a conflicting engagement. And then the next week he'll give both lectures. And some people thought that Dr. Heiklin's lectures were optional because she was a guest lecturer. Let me tell you, this is not correct, and it's not correct for Dr. Feierstein either.